Morning, everybody. All right. Morning. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. And Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6. It's Monday. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more. Join me each week to review all the new movies, and then Eric and I will talk about the box office numbers for the weekend as well. And we do this every Monday morning. And it is Monday. That means my dad will be calling in to tell a joke, because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. All right. We got a lot of movies to talk about this week, so we should get right to it. Eric Childress and Colin Suter. Eric, how are you?
Okay.
And Colin, how are you?
Very good.
Welcome. Welcome, welcome. All right, let's see. Well, you know what, Colin, why don't you start us off with, lo and behold, this is the new Werner Herzog documentary.
Yeah, it's the full title is Lo and Behold, Reveries of a Connected World. And here he examines the internet and its stranglehold on our culture. He goes to where the internet was really invented, the first machine that connected, you know, one computer to another. He visits with, you know, a world-renowned hacker, a family that was, you know, harassed online after the death of one of the daughters. People who live in places where there is no cell tower, no internet, nothing, so they can live healthy lives because they're having bad reactions to cell towers and everything. He also explores not just the internet, but robotics and artificial intelligence and, you know, the possible colonization of Mars. And he does all of this in 90 minutes. And it's a fascinating journey. And you'd think, you know, with Herzog, oh, he must be, you know, probably the kind of guy who's against the internet and against all this stuff. But he's really not. And it's what's interesting is that the movie maintains this humanity throughout the whole thing. It's not a diatribe. It's not a lecture of any kind. It's really kind of a fascination with all this stuff. About you do leave the theater thinking about how you use technology in your life and what role it plays and how really like we're all just, you know, a part of one big microchip. You know, we've become the physical embodiment of a large microchip. It sounds like, you know, the way I'm describing it, it sounds like, you know, some stoner, you know, conversation you have late at night, you know, during college. But really, this is a movie about, you know, where we're at right now with technology, and there's no going back. And, it's kind of a scary thing to think about at times. It's kind of a funny thing to think about at times. And it's there's hope in it. And a lot of Herzog's sort of trademark dark humor. When the scientist says, you know, well, we're having a, you know, we're not sure who we're going to put on Mars. We're not sure who, you know, what we're going to do about that. Herzog is the first to say, I'll go put me on the spaceship. I'll definitely go to Mars. You know, everyone was going to leave the theater doing their Herzog imitation.
Yeah.
It's definitely going to make you do that. He's all over this thing. And it's Herzog doing his thing and being, you know, one of the one of the most fascinating documentary filmmakers or even narrative filmmakers working. And this is, you know, definitely worth seeing, you know, whether or not you're a Herzog fan or, you know, even know his work. Yeah, I think everybody should definitely see this film.
All right. I can't wait to see it. I love Werner Herzog. He's nuts. And
sure.
And I also want to mention the poster for this movie. The poster is phenomenal.
Which one? I've seen two posters.
Yeah, the poster that that's up in front of me is what appears to be a man with a suit on, but his head is completely made up of wires and connected.
Yeah, that's a great one. The other one is the one that we had at our film festival. This movie played the Chicago Critics Film Festival. The one we have is equally fascinating, and it's an image from the film, and it's that of monks Tibetan monks in Chicago on the Chicago lakefront, all staring at their cell phones.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. So lo and behold, Reveries of the Connected World, which is you can watch it now on it's streaming.
I believe it is playing at the Landmark Century. Let me double check that.
The Landmark Century.
Or the Renaissance.
The Renaissance as well. Okay. And Eric, you didn't get a chance to see it?
Not yet.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, there you go. That's the first movie, lo and behold, Reveries of the Connected World. We go from Werner Herzog to Jason Statham. Eric, you're the only one that bit the bullet on this one. Mechanic Resurrection, the new Statham blockbuster.
Yeah, it's almost like rubbing it into my face. I didn't see Werner Herzog, but I went and saw the new Jason Statham movie. So Mechanic Resurrection, for those of you who may not be familiar with his mechanic character, well, it's Arthur Bishop. You know, everyone remembers Arthur Bishop.
Well, I do from the original.
Oh, was his name Arthur Bishop?
Yeah, his name was Bishop. I don't know if it was Arthur, but it was Bishop for sure.
Okay, they give him a first name.
Okay, but I mean the Bronson the movie the mechanic the Charles Bronson movie.
Yeah,
that's my favorite. That's my favorite Charles Bronson movie of all time. It's one of my dad's favorite movies. I saw it a ton of times when I was a kid. And, you know, the fact that they were going to remake it is just idiotic. But and the fact that there's a sequel to it is even more idiotic.
Yeah, well, you know, not that we're spoiling much, but at the end of the first movie, he sort of faked his death, if I remember correctly. I remember, like, I kind of remembered liking the remake of the movie, but I don't remember a thing about it other than Ben Foster played a twitchy character like he always plays. That's about all I remember. And there was a car explosion at the end.
Yeah, in the original, I don't remember the remake. I don't even know if I don't think I've seen the whole thing.
Okay.
It's on cable. It was on cable a few times, and I watched a little bit of it here and there. But in the original, Bronson's character dies.
Right.
At the end of the, and he gets killed. The Jan Michael Vincent, the trainee guy.
Yes.
Ben Foster played his role. Michael Vincent kills Bronson, like poisons him. But then there's a note in the car at the end of the movie where Bronson knew he was going to kill him. So that's why the car blows up at the end. The original, Jan Michael Vincent gets blown up and he's killed by a dead Bronson.
Yeah, something very similar happens in the Statham version, except obviously he survived.
Right.
or did he? Because he's now been resurrected.
Right.
But Arthur Bishop is back, and he sort of is trying to put his past life as an assassin for hire behind him. He ends up going to Thailand, to a little, like, the most beautiful part of Thailand you can possibly imagine. Every time I think of Thailand, I think of, like, Return to Paradise or something like that. But it's a beautiful island spot of Thailand where Michelle Yeoh runs a little Club Paradise over there or something. And then he's trying to chill out, and then Jessica Alba walks into his life. And Jessica Alba is, get this, an ex-CIA operative who gave up life in the war zone to teach Cambodian children.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Okay. Now, if you followed any of the backstory, that the stories that have come out about this movie, we'll get back to the movie in a second. Jessica Alba has gone on record with interviews saying that she wanted them to give some depth to her character. And so, like, currently, this is the backstory they come up with, and you get that backstory on, like, a news story on a tablet or something. But anyway, so she shows up, and she's basically been kidnapped and being used to fake some sort of domestic violence incident. So Statham will get involved, and then he will fall in love with her, and then he will let his guard down and then be, taken hostage himself so he can do three kills for a guy that he used to have the same adoptive father for.
All right, listen, hang on a second,
Eric.
Yeah, hang on. Hold on. Hold on a second. We got to take a break for the news here. So hold on. And I know that everybody will be waiting with bated breath to find out the rest of the plot of Mechanic Resurrection, Jason Statham's new movie, and Eric's thought on it. We got to take a break. It is Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. The movie reviews will continue with Eric Childress and Colin Suter. Box office as well. That's all coming up. We're breaking right now for the news, and we'll be back after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are back live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. How's everybody doing? A little bit later on, we're going to be talking about the BBC released what they consider to be the top 100 films of the 21st century so far. So we'll talk about that list, and then I'm going to bust out some of my favorites of the 21st century as well. I've watched a lot of films over the weekend from the 2000s and on and forward to sort of prepare. So I put like a list together, and you know we'll talk about that as well. And my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning. It's a jokey time, and it is Monday, so that means the Monday morning movie reviews are underway as we speak. Eric Childress, Colin Suter. And before the break, Eric was telling us about the incredible plotting of Mechanic Resurrection. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right. So continue, Mechanic Resurrection.
Yeah. So he's basically sort of blackmailed into doing these three kills for this guy. Otherwise, they're going to kill Jessica Alba. So it's basically Commando, except he has to kill three people instead of just Dan Hedaya. The president that Dan Hedaya wants him to kill, whatever. So he has to, at one point, he has to break into a prison to kill a warlord that's in jail. He has to, if you've seen the previews, he has to get on the outside of this swimming pool that's outside a penthouse to drain the pool so the guy will fall to his death. And just more elaborate schemes throughout the way. In the this has been a summer of the most unnecessary sequels we've seen in any particular season.
Yeah.
This might be the topper for several reasons. You know, one, at least one we'll get in during the box office. But I don't know who was calling for another Jason Statham movie just because he's been in like Furious 7 and Spy. And particularly, why would you do a sequel to Mechanic when I think if you could just call this movie anything. And it would have just it could have been a sequel to any one of his movies. They're just so interchangeable. It didn't really seem to matter. Just let Statham punch people and Jessica Alba swim in a bikini. We've seen this hundreds of times before. And this movie starts off so sloppily put together that there's actually a moment when Statham is supposed to be going from his island hut to the boat where Jessica Alba is being smacked around, and he's on a little rubber life raft with a motor, and the camera is got it framed to such a point that I'm pretty positive that Jason Statham is literally just in the boat rocking it back and forth and not going anywhere to give it the appearance of motion,
right.
and they do it twice, and then as the movie went along, and it keeps getting more ridiculous, and the set pieces and the violence keeps getting even really more extreme by the end of this movie. It just keeps getting dumber, and I let my guard down a little bit, so I wasn't completely not enjoying it, but it's a really stupid movie. It's really pretty sloppily put together. The villain is a nothing. If all you just want to see is Statham punch some people, you've pretty much seen that before. You've seen Jessica Alba swim in a bikini before and close-ups. There's nothing here worth a single one of your dollars. They're far better, mindless, violent pieces of entertainment out there. I don't know why we need another event, another adventure in the history of Arthur Bishop.
Now, I've not seen the film, obviously, but I've seen, the commercials. What's going on with Tommy Lee Jones?
Oh, thanks. It's funny you should mention it.
Yeah.
I was an hour into the movie. Okay, this movie's only like 95 minutes long. I'm an hour into the movie. I completely forgot Tommy Lee Jones was in this movie. He's literally got about 6 minutes of screen time. He shows up. He's the final person he's supposed to kill.
Yeah.
But then it finds out there's like a conflict of interest and, it's like he's the lesser of two evils kind of thing. But I'm telling you that Tommy Lee Jones actually seems to care more about his 6 minutes of screen time in this movie, and it's basically him acting with a soul patch, pretty much, than he does in the entirety of Jason Bourne. I think Tommy Lee Jones cared more about Mechanic Resurrection than he did Jason Bourne.
Okay. All right. Mechanic Resurrection, not one thing new here.
No.
All right. And it's out there for the taking if you would like it. All right. Let's go to Colin. Why don't you tell us about Hands of Stone?
Okay, but first let me correct myself on the Lo and Behold, the Werner Herzog film. It's playing at the Music Box.
Oh.
And it's also available on demand. So.
Right. I know it's available on demand, but if you want to see it in the theaters, it's at the Music Box. Okay, cool.
Yeah. All right, so Hands of Stone. This is a biopic about Roberto Duran. Edgar Ramirez plays Duran. And the film follows his life in Panama, where he started boxing at the age of 16. He started in 1968 and, you know, slowly became a phenomenon throughout the 70s and, you know, did his country proud. Robert De Niro plays Ray Arcel, his longtime manager and trainer, who had the, you know, biggest influence on his life, both inside the ring and outside. And the film, you know, covers his life, you know, from teenager to, you know, present day, and his legendary fight with Sugar Ray Leonard, played by Usher, and as well as the, you know, the rematch and all that, and how they, you know, eventually became friends. Ana de Armas, who we just saw in War Dogs, plays his wife. And yeah, that's pretty much what it is. It's pretty much a biopic, you know, kind of a by the numbers biopic that, you know, you would expect when you go see a biopic. But this one is a Weinstein film, which means it has been all cut to heck and as useless voiceover narration. In this case, coming from Robert De Niro's character, who, you know, is only in about half the film. So how could he narrate, you know, when he's not in most of, you know, Duran's life, or in the, at least in this film? And that's the sense you get when you watch this film, is that somebody took what was, may have been an interesting, you know, certainly an interesting idea for a film, certainly a life worth exploring. You get the sense that this movie has been taken away from something and has been cut and refashioned and turned into a, you know, an economical hour and 45 minutes, but certainly not, I think that's how long it is, but certainly not interesting. It is, you know, over-edited, some of the worst cinematography choices I've seen. It has, you know, just narrative choices that make you kind of scratch your head and go, well, wait, what just happened? Why are we here now all of a sudden? And the boxing scenes are just over edited. And, you know, you get the sense that, oh, we're just going to cast Robert De Niro because he's in Raging Bull, and it'll be a callback to that. I don't think anybody in this movie or anybody involved with this movie watched Raging Bull or even learned anything from it. And this is just kind of a big mess. This is an unfortunate case of somebody who has an interesting life story being turned into a movie that really has no sense of purpose behind telling the story. It just kind of sits there and moves along at a pace that, you know, I think the Weinsteins think the American public prefers. And, you know, it just kind of, you'll leave the theater feeling nothing or feeling like, gee, I bet this would be a better documentary than an actual film. It's unfortunate, but that's the case. That's what we have here, is a movie that is a good story, but really sloppily made and not very well told.
Okay. All right, Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I think it's even worse than that. It's one thing to see, like, a film that might have some potential taken away from the Weinsteins and just kind of chopped up and put voice over and over. But I don't even see where the film was here that could have been really tampered with. It's like everything Colin said is absolutely true. It's really sloppily put together as far as point of views are concerned. I'm not exactly sure what this film feels about Roberto Duran or what we're supposed to feel about him. For a good portion of the movie, he's really kind of portrayed as a real jerk. Once we sort of get into the rivalry between him and Sugar Ray Leonard, I don't know if the movie is taking a point of view that you know, because Roberto Duran was fighting for something and Sugar Ray Leonard was just a pretty boy who just happened to be a really nice guy in the boxing game, that we're supposed to look down upon him and, you know, praise what Duran was doing. I don't think the movie has any sense of purpose there either. And it's like having De Niro do the voice, do the narration is just so off-putting. They throw Don King in there for a brief moment, really late in the film. Film never really sort of penetrates the corrupt world of boxing, and there's really awkward stuff too, like the courtship of Duran and his wife. The first scene we see to them, they have Edgar Ramirez, not a younger version of him, hitting on Ana de Armas in a schoolgirl outfit, and he looks like he's 40 years old, and she looks like she's 14. It's very awkward and off-putting. I don't know why you want to portray this movie through the eyes of the trainer, and especially when you lead off narration saying that this guy changed my life. I think we're well past stories like that. I think it's one of the worst films of the year.
Okay. All right, hang on, you guys. I'll tell you what I thought of it when we take a break here, and we'll come back with more. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, both not recommending Hands of Stone, the new boxing film. And we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, I'll give you my thoughts, and we'll review the rest of the new movies right here on 720 WGN. Right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower, and we're here till 5. And our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter at Nick D Show. We are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews, which we do every Monday. Eric Childress, Colin Suter are here, and they just gave you their thoughts on Hands of Stone, which is the new boxing film. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
I echo everything you guys said. This movie is an absolute mess. And everything that you guys said about the problem with the storytelling and the narration is absolutely true. I didn't think Edgar Ramirez was particularly. I don't know. I don't think he was very well cast. This guy. Roberto Duran, actually, his story is really amazing and deserves much better than this. And I don't know, the history of this movie. Did it sit on a shelf, Eric, for a while? Or
no, it played Cannes this year.
It did?
Yeah.
Wow. It just feels like a movie that's been sitting around on a shelf.
Sure.
You know, it's been, as we've mentioned now, all three of us have mentioned this, and it looks like it feels like it's been messed with and recut with all the narration and all that stuff. And it seems like there's a lot of stuff that would have been on the cutting room floor. I think it just does a disservice to Roberto Duran's story. And the rivalry that he had with Sugar Ray Leonard, that was legendary stuff, man. And what should be the basis of a compelling and really good film, and it isn't. It's an absolute mess. It didn't even crack the top 10 at the box office.
No, but it's on a limited amount of screens. They're going wider with it later this week.
Oh, okay, all right. And I don't know. End of August seems like an odd time to release this movie, but. I really don't see, if it came out in October, if it would make any difference. So, Hands of Stone, it's not good. It is an absolute mess. So let us move on. All right. Let's see. Eric, why don't you tell us about Morris from America?
Okay. This is another film that played. This is our opening night film, as a matter of fact, at the Chicago Critics Film Festival this year. And it's the story of Morris, 13-year-old boy who has had to move to Germany with his dad, played by Craig Robinson, who's taken a job out there coaching soccer. And so Morris sort of has to do his best to fit in with the the German kids and the German culture, which he's, you know, having some trouble doing. He actually has some aspirations of being a rapper, some things that his dad teaches him some life lessons on. His dad had some previous experience wanting to be a rapper himself. And through the, you know, sort of the foregoing sort of some of the usual sort of things that we're used to in kids, you know, sort of fish out of water stories, coming of age stories, Morris actually has two particular relationships with women in his life. His mom has passed on. One of them is his tutor, played by Carla Jury, who helps him obviously through school and you know, teaches him some other things as well. And then there's a young girl that he meets on the playground or in the schoolyard, played by Lena Keller, who is I think she's a bit old, a little bit older, and certainly clearly a little bit more experienced in the world, hanging out with crowds and things that seemingly a little more adult. And so the two of them sort of strike up a friendship, and he's got clearly got a, has a bit of a crush on her. And this movie is sort of their the experiences of this boy and trying to come to, you know, try to, you know, massage all these things that are going on with him in his life while maintaining relationships with the real adults in his life. And this is a film that was written and directed by Chad Hartigan, who did the really terrific This is Martin Bonner, which actually played our very first film festival. And he's really a really great writer and observer of sort of the just human interaction, and just, you know, understanding the sort of the doubts and the fears that people have, and trying to react to new environments and things. And he really gets some really terrific work. Marquis Christmas is really good as Morris, and most notably Craig Robinson probably does probably the best work of his career in this movie. This is, you know, while this movie is very funny at times and has a number of comedic elements to it, it most definitely would be classified in the drama category. And he has a monologue very late in the film to his son that is probably my favorite monologue moment of the year. The way it's not just the way it's performed, but the way it's filmed and put together, and it ends so wonderfully. It's just so beautifully performed and written by Chad Hartigan and performed by Craig Robinson. This is just a really nice movie. It's funny. You know, it's got really interesting characters, and all the acting is really good. People really should seek this one out.
Okay, all right, Colin.
Yeah, I really like this film too, and I really like Chad Hartigan's movies. I mean, I think he's an interesting voice. He's kind of like the, you know, Kenneth Lonergan, that sort of sensibility. And I echo everything Eric said about the performances in this movie. Craig Robinson it's really nice to see him kind of step into a film like this and step into a role like this, where he is given really good material to work with. He doesn't have to improvise his way through it. And it's really nice to see. I really like this Marquis Christmas too. He's a wonderful young actor who's given a scene that is very, you know, would be uncomfortable for any young actor to do. And it's a scene that, you know, it's not, there's no dialogue in it, but he's got to do, he does, there's a moment in the film, and you'll know it when you see it, where, you know, it's like any young actor would see this in the script, they're like, oh God, I got to do this. And, but he does it wonderfully. It's a wonderful, very intimate, very funny, very kind of beautiful, sad scene. And, you know, and I really like what I appreciate about this film overall is that, the choices that Chad Hartigan made for this kind of coming of age film, you know, a lot of directors, you know, a lot of people can make a coming of age film. You know, they make it about a character who resembles them and resembles their story and is very personal and everything. But I like that he, you know, sort of took this, making a coming of age story, instead of making it about, you know, white kids in the city, let's make it about this. Let's make it an African American. And instead of having it in America, let's put it in Germany. it's still the same kind of story, still the same kind of coming of age tropes, but he made these choices that just added a little bit, made it stand out a little bit more, made it a little more different. And I really appreciate that. This guy's a really wonderful writer director. Like Eric said, people need to seek this one out, and you kind of have to seek it out. It's only playing at the Arclight Theater in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But definitely look for it.
It also is you can stream it.
Okay.
On Amazon, at least. I'm looking at that. You can stream it on Amazon, so I think it's available in some of the VOD areas. But yeah, the Arclight Theater in Chicago is the only theater that it is playing at. And so now, do you guys had who came in for this one, Eric?
Craig Robinson and Chad Hardigan were here.
Oh, okay.
Opening night.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very, very cool. All right, well, that's Morris from America, which, again, is only playing at the Arclight Theater in Chicago. And have you guys been to that theater?
Have not.
I went there. I didn't see anything. I was going to, long story, but I got there and saw how unbelievably expensive it was and decided not to go.
Yeah.
It's one of those places where they serve your food at your theater seat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I went there once and, I went, of course I went there to see Mad Max. I just tried to see that movie in as many theaters as possible, I guess.
Sure.
But it's set up weirdly, like it's a train station.
Oh yeah,
and your
ticket—it's like a ticket kiosk.
Yeah, there's like
a ticket seller.
Exactly, and the tickets themselves are—they look like train tickets, and it's just there's a giant clock in the middle of the place. I just found the place to be just very strange. It's a weird place, but it's the only place you can see Morris from America. So Eric and Colin are highly recommending it. I didn't get a chance to see it, but you go to the Arclight Theater in Chicago, or you can watch it on video on demand. And there you go. Okay, guys, hang on. We got to take a break for the news. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress is with us. Colin Suter is with us. And we review the new movies every Monday morning. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can check us out at facebook.com/NickDShow and like us there. And we'll come back after the news. We got more movies to talk about. And then Eric and I will talk about the box office as well. All right here on 720 WGN. Stay tuned. Back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studios, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran, the great Steve Cochran, at 6 a.m. with your morning drive. Coming up in a little bit, we're going to talk about the BBC's list of the top 100 films of the 21st century so far. And so I'm going to give you my thoughts on some of those and that stuff as well. My dad will call in and tell a joke. Because it's a jokey time. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are talking about the movies, and we'll get to box office in a little bit. Eric Childress and Colin Suter are on the show. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
Okay. Colin, mm-hmm. Could you tell us about South Side with You?
Yeah, this is the film about the reenactment of Michelle and Barack Obama's first date in Chicago back in the summer of 89. Tika Robinson plays Michelle Obama, or Michelle Robinson, in this film, and Parker Sawyers plays Barack Obama. And the date really isn't a date at first, at least not to Michelle. To her, this is an afternoon with a colleague, an aspiring lawyer, and she has ambitions of her own and doesn't want to get into a romantic relationship with anyone. But Barack's ulterior motive for this afternoon is to woo her and show her a good time. For those of us here, who know our Chicago geography, we know the date doesn't stick to the south side. They kind of go all over the place. But never mind that. They go to the Art Institute. They end up at the Music Box Theater, where they see Do the Right Thing. And, they go all over. But that's not important. The important part is how their relationship develops over the course of this date. And that's what makes this such a unique little biopic, for lack of a better term, because we as viewers know how this ends. And we also, watch while projecting our knowledge of what this couple will become. And even without that, though, this is a very engaging and funny and romantic film that owes a lot to Before Sunset. But with interesting debates, between the two of them about politics and law and the end of Do the Right Thing. But it's not, it's a first date film about these two people that we know very well. But if it were about two strangers, it would be equally as good. The chemistry between the two of them is very apparent. It's very evident. This film is very well cast with these two actors playing them. But it just happens to be that much more fascinating because of what we know this couple will be. And you kind of watch it going, man, it's such a long way off from where we are right now. Or where they are right now in their relationship. It's interesting to see, even if it's just a reenactment, even if it's not that accurate, a reenactment of, a very meaningful day that, would end up, changing everything as we know it. There are things in the script that kind of drove me nuts that I kind of wish they would have left out of the script once these actors were cast. There's a point at which, Michelle Obama makes fun of Barack Obama's ears, and there's nothing distinctive about this actor's ears that they cast, to play Barack Obama. And the same thing with Michelle, somebody at the Music Box, says, oh, I knew that was you. Cause I, who can miss you? You're so tall. The actress in this movie is not very tall. So, like, stuff like that they could have left out of the script. but that's nitpicking. This is a really, really terrific film, really beautifully written. And it's a directorial debut from Richard Tanney, whose only other directorial credit is a short film that I've not seen. But this is an interesting starting off point for a director who, could have a very interesting career to come. Okay. So definitely recommend it.
All right, Eric?
Yeah. It really takes guts to make a movie that 40% of the country is guaranteed to never look at ever or give a chance to. And I bring that up to say is that, while this movie, is basically, it makes no secret of the fact that this is a movie about the president and the first lady at a time when long before they were the president and the first lady. This is a film that, while it's not political in essence in a way, but what it does is that in a very sort of clever way, it's sort of laying the groundwork as you're watching this guy and you're just sitting there and going, yeah, this guy is going to be president of the United States someday. Even if you didn't know, it would have been very interesting if they would have tried to actually do the movie and not, like, say their names. And then at the end you sort of find out. I don't know if that would have cheapened the experience, but it would have been interesting to sort of look through the prism of, sort of an unbiased lens at these two people, because everything Colin said about this movie is dead on. This is a beautiful, incredibly charming, very cool movie at times. The chemistry between the two of them are great. Do the comparisons to Before Sunset, are they that the Before trilogy? Yes, absolutely. But, if you're going to base a movie and pattern a movie off of, that's a pretty good place to start. And this is all, this is the kind of movie that could have gone bad and silly in so many different ways. You know, it's a first-timer's effort. They've got a subject matter that is easily going to either, you know, garner attention and controversy. And it just, you know, it could have just been a collection of the sort of the nitpicky things that Colin, you know, talked about, the ears and the height and, you know, little catchphrases or things that we know about the Obamas. But it's not that. Those stuff are kind of thrown in maybe for little, you know, kitschy trivia type things. But this movie is about two people, and it's about a man and a woman on the first date. I love the fact that she doesn't consider it a date, and he is doing everything in his power to make it, to sort of get to that moment at the end of the movie that, you know, anyone who's familiar with the story is waiting for, and it really, you know, pulls that off pretty beautifully. This was one of the best movies I saw at Sundance this year, and it's certainly one of the best movies out in theaters right now.
Yeah, I thought this was a really lovely film. Really well acted. The two actors, by the way, Tika Sumpner, by the way, was on Gossip Girl. I just want to make that clear. So she gets a pass right away. But anyway, this is a really great movie. It's just a wonderful, simple, lovely little film. And I would like to, you know, preface this by saying it doesn't matter to me, at least. It doesn't matter what side of the politics you're on, whether you're pro or you're anti-Obama or whatever. This is just a really nice film about two people starting a relationship. And that's what it's about. Now, it just so happens that there is, you know, obviously the backstory is pretty huge. And again, as Colin, as you were saying, we all kind of bring what we know now about this couple while we're watching this film, which, you know, takes place in 1989. And, you know, it's beautifully written. It's really simple. It's really lovely. And, it's weird because, like you said, Eric, a lot of people aren't going to see this movie simply because of who it's about and what it's about, which is really too bad. And you know, and I'm trying to leave politics out of this. It's just a really good film that people should see. That's all I'm saying is that, these are two really good actors doing a really nice job, and it's very reminiscent, as you guys both said, of the Before movies, the Richard Linklater Before movies. But there's nothing wrong with that, and it does jump all around, all around the city, not just on the South Side. And if I remember correctly, Do the Right Thing didn't play the music box.
I've heard this.
I remember when Do the Right Thing opened up, and it didn't play the music box, but so what?
Do they show the actual music box, like neon marquee? I mean, I'm trying to think if they actually masked it or if it was just that happened to be the theater where they shot it.
I
don't remember.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. If you live here, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then you know the theater. If you don't, right. They don't go, hey, let's go to the music box to see.
Right.
But you know it's the music box. If you're from Chicago, then you know it, you know?
Yeah.
It's one of the most beautiful and distinctive theaters in the city, or in the world, actually. But if you're not familiar with, you know, the Chicago landscape, if you're not familiar with the music box, it just looks like a nice theater, you know, and, you know, that's all. But, you know, the nitpicky stuff that you brought up, Colin, I don't know. It just seems like that was kind of put in there. It didn't bother me. It was kind of like, all right. But I think they just kind of threw that in there just to give us more, to be more familiar.
Yeah.
About it. It didn't bother me. It didn't take me out of the movie at all. I just think both of these performances are great. The chemistry is really good. It's a very sweet film. It's funny. It's charming. It uses the city really well. And it tells an interesting story about the beginning of a relationship, and it just so happens to be about the beginning of a relationship between the president and the first lady. I think it's a wonderful film. I really do. And it's playing everywhere. It's in a bunch of theaters. It's an interesting, Eric, this is interesting because it's a really little film, but it's in like 50 theaters.
Yeah, I was surprised at it, and they kind of snuck it on everyone. I mean, I was only completely expecting this to be just a very limited run. It opened in New York and L.A. last week, and then it expanded this week. But sometime in the middle of last week, they announced that they were going to throw it out there on 800 screens. And you know, bravo to Roadside for doing it, because I didn't think that they were going to do it. I mean, I'll bring this up in the box office, too, but this is the same studio that released a Tom Hanks movie on less screens than this movie.
Yeah, that's crazy. All right, you guys, hang on, okay? We got to take a break. And when we come back, we got one more movie to talk about, and it's called Don't Breathe. And we'll tell you all about that one right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're going to talk about the box office in just a little bit, but we got one more movie to talk about here. Let's welcome back Eric and Colin. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right, Eric. Tell us about Don't Breathe.
Okay. Well, I saw this movie when it premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival, when it was known simply as Untitled Fede Alvarez / Ghost House Thriller. this movie came into South By without a title, and it's a story of these three basically hooligans in Detroit, right?
Yeah.
In Detroit, who are basically going to rob the house of this blind man played by Stephen Lang, because they've heard that he received a very nice financial settlement as a result of his daughter dying. So the hooligans are going to break into his house. So one of them, played by Jane Levy, who starred in Alvarez's Evil Dead remake, was his previous film, and she's hoping that this will be the score that'll get her is it her daughter or her sister?
It's her younger sister.
It is her sister. I thought it was her daughter when I first saw it. Then I saw people saying it's her sister. Okay. So we're going to get her younger sister out of Detroit. So they break into the house, and let's just say things don't go entirely as planned. That's all you really need to know. Because this is a film that, if you've seen the previews, you've seen about half of what the twists and turns and whatnot. And then there are some further ones. So getting to whether or not the movie is good or not, when I saw the movie, I had seen like the second screening at South By, and it was garnering a lot of really solid praise, which tends to happen to some of the midnight films until you actually see them. But this one, I thought the first act of the movie, before you sort of really get to the meat of the story, I thought was very clunky. I thought some of the acting was not so great. I think that the setup of the movie is a little, just not really doing it for me. Then once the herd is thinned a little bit, the movie really sort of plunges forward into some really terrific space in the house. Some really terrific set pieces put through there. Alvarez has like a really great sense of the geography of the house, which really sort of aids in both the claustrophobia of the situation. These guys, exactly where our rooting interest lies is, on edge for at least about half the movie. Then the movie, I think, kind of mistakenly gives us exactly who to root for. I think that it didn't bother me as much as some people, but I think that lessens it a little bit. But the movie, like I said, the movie continues to plunge forward with some really great stuff. Some really creepy stuff happens, and then it just keeps going all the way up until the end. It's whether you want to classify it as a thriller or a horror movie, I've heard it described as both. It's really sort of capping off a really good summer for horror and a pretty good year for horror, as far as I'm concerned. I don't quite like it or love it as much as some people do, but like I said, the once you get past the clunky first act, I think it's a really solid film.
Okay. Colin?
I love this movie. I thought it was great. And I didn't find the first act clunky at all. I was actually kind of on board with the whole thing. And I'm so glad Eric left out a lot of, you know, in the plot description. I think that's just all you need to know going in. In fact, if you can, you know, not know that, it's even better. I knew nothing going into this movie. And I found, you know, that, you know, the movie does one of those, you know, the very common thing now where it shows you a shot or a scene that's going to happen later. They show it at the very beginning of the film. I wasn't sure that was the right choice with this movie, but I actually thought it, you know, it actually does pay off eventually. I think the performances are really good. I actually found, you know, that the chemistry or dynamic between the three thieves is very believable. And the fact that they're, you know, going, they're not all on board with going into this house and attempting this, you know, it's kind of nice that there's, you know, at least one of these three who's kind of the voice for the audience who knows that this is not a good idea. I think there's, you know, stuff in this movie where I was kind of white knuckling it, very claustrophobic. Like Eric said, the geography of the house is very important and very well conveyed. And there's some ingenious scenes and sequences, you know, involving, you know, glass and power tools and everything. And it is just like Eric said, it just keeps going. And the twists, I think, are a lot of fun. The, you know, the sort of, you're not really sure who to root for. It's kind of ambiguous at first. You're not quite on board with these thieves making it, you know, through this whole thing. On the other hand, another point, you're not really against them. And it's, I love that setup. I love, you know, sort of the way the movie kind of plays with the audience in that way. I've never been more afraid of an animal than I have, I think, when watching a film. I mean, I really just was terrified of you know, some the character in the film. And I loved it. I loved it. When it was over, I was like, that is what I love about horror movies and what I love about thrillers. And yeah, I don't know what to call it either. It works both ways, as a thriller or a horror film, because it is definitely a white knuckle, you know, very tense and a lot of fun, a very fun experience. I saw this at the Lake Street screening room, and I kind of looked around at, you know, a lot of the critics who were around me, and we just had big grins on their faces, like we were just having a ball watching this thing. I highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun. It's scary. It wraps itself up in a really terrific way. And it is made, you know, with such precision and skill that it's just a treat to sit through. And I think a great way to cap off what has been a dreadful summer.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say here. this movie rules. It is so beautifully constructed and so beautifully made. I didn't find the setup clunky at all. I was with this movie from the opening frame to the last scene. And it's a very simple premise, which I think makes it all the more intense. It's only like 88 minutes long, you know, and it's like this simple setup. Here's the deal. Three thieves gonna rob this blind guy in his house. Things go wrong. That's the setup, and the way that it unfolds and the surprises that continue to happen. Like, this is a surprising film. Every 10 minutes something happens in this movie, you go, what? You know what I mean? Like, the twists keep coming, and the suspense keeps building, and it becomes even more ingenious with each setup. It's like, how are they going to top what just happened? How are they going to get this character to do this or to get to this point? And it's so clever, and the twists are so well executed. And I think all the acting is great in it. There's essentially, you know, there's only four people in the movie. I mean, there are some other characters on the outskirts that show up at the beginning of the film to set it up. But for the most part, it's just these four people. And all four of the performances are good. I don't even know what to say about Jane Levy. I love her. And as I've said before, her performance in Evil Dead, in the remake of Evil Dead, is, I think, one of the best horror performances since Angela Bettis in May. And I think she's phenomenal in this movie, too. And we haven't mentioned Stephen Lang, man. Stephen Lang rules in this movie. He's scary. He plays the blind guy. And you know, the weird motivation that you discover about this guy as the movie goes on, I bought it. It becomes a little bit outrageous as it goes on, but he does it so convincingly, and he is so dedicated to this part that I bought everything he did. Not just physically, but it's a very physical performance and a really good one. But like, there's a lot of weirdness and pain and craziness in this guy, and it all comes through with very minimal dialogue. And that's another thing about this movie. There's not a ton of dialogue in this movie. This movie is about setting set pieces in motion, and Alvarez is a remarkably talented at building suspense, unleashing creativity that you don't expect, and making surprise after surprise after surprise. This is an incredibly suspenseful movie. It's very scary. It's also really clever and at times very funny. This is the kind of movie, I love this movie. I loved every frame of this movie, and I'm going to see it many, many times. It's easily one of my favorite films of the year, if not my favorite film that I've seen all year. This is just great horror thriller filmmaking at its at the top. You know, it doesn't get much better than this. A perfectly constructed thriller/horror movie that starts out great and gets even better by the end. I loved every minute of this movie. Don't Breathe. And you guys are not surprised by my reaction to this. You guys, I remember, you know,
I'm more surprised by my reaction to it. I mean, not that I had low expectations going in, but I just thought, I don't know what this is, but I'm going to watch it.
Yeah,
that's, you know, I don't know. I don't know what this is, but I came here to see it. So
yeah, it is a great movie, and it did really well at the box office, which we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes. So Don't Breathe, great, 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 great movie. All right, now next week we're off because of Labor Day. And then the following week, the big movie, obviously, is Clint Eastwood's Sully with Tom Hanks. That's the big one the following week. So, all right. Well, Colin, thanks, man.
All righty.
And we will talk to you next week.
All right.
All right. Good. See you there. There's Colin. Eric, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk box office with Eric Childress right after we take a break for the news here on 720 WGN. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It is Monday morning, and we just finished up the movie reviews, and now we're going to talk about box office with Eric Childress. And then we're going to talk about the top 100 movies of the 21st century according to BBC's list. And then I'll throw out some of my favorite titles from the past 16 years or so. The list from the BBC inspired me to kind of watch some stuff from the 2000s and then take a look back at some of my lists and throw some of those titles out there as well. And we'd love for you to come in, too, at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show and, of course, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, Eric Childress writes a piece about the box office that you can read on movies.com. And Eric, tell everybody how they can see you on the TVs as well.
Yes, every Thursday morning at 5 a.m., set your DVRs for Business First AM and do a segment called Movies and Money with Angela Miles. And basically, I review a couple of the new releases of the week and talk about their box office potential and then just how box office is performing all over the place.
Okay. All right, well, let's get into this week's box office. We just reviewed it. Don't Breathe opened up with $26.1 million. Now, and you called that one, Eric.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I said 26 million, but it's funny to me, and it's a little aggravating too, that a lot of people are using the word overperform to describe this number for Don't Breathe. And to me, when you use the word overperform to describe something, you're basically saying that it overperformed over your own expectations.
Right.
For it. It's not so much that this movie, $26 million is a good, healthy number, and not a lot of people predicted it, but a lot of people have this opening somewhere between, like, $11 and $14 million. Mm. You know? And so, yeah, of course, it exceeded your expectations. It might be a surprise, but it didn't overperform, because if you look at the way horror has been over the past few years, you get a movie, especially ones that are well-reviewed, the horror fans will show up in droves. For then, even you can a movie like Don't Breathe, which we keep saying, is it a thriller? Is it a horror movie?
Right.
You can get people who you might not show up for a horror movie, but they will show up for a good suspense movie, which this movie clearly is. And yeah, so $26 million is a fantastic number.
Yeah.
For this movie.
Yeah. And what was the budget on this?
I don't know. It's small.
Yeah.
It's something like $15 million,
yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah,
it's very small. So I mean, just like like Lights Out, was a $5 million budget and it's grossed over $100 million worldwide. This is already basically, you can just label it a hit.
Yeah. Okay. And then number two, Suicide Squad with $12.1 million. This will hit $300 million, don't you think?
It looks like it now. Yeah, it's busted out of its Twilight realm, as I've been calling it the last couple of weeks. It seemed to be on pace with some of the Twilight films because it was dropping off pretty steadily. But now that we've kind of gotten into the dog days of summer, the drops have been kind of steadied out a little bit, and that there really hasn't been anything, surprisingly enough, to challenge it enough at the top. It's just, it's finally settling into number two. So now it's looking like it's probably somewhere around $305 to $310 million, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Number three, Kubo and the Two Strings, one of the best movies of the year, $7.9 million, bringing its total in 2 weeks to just $25 million.
Yeah, nice to see it jump up from four to three.
Yeah.
That was kind of nice. Actually, I mean, at one point, Peter Dragon was considered to, like, it looked like it was going to be in the number three slot. But, 37% drop, that's nice to see. But, 37% drop would have been much nicer on, a $60 million opening, like a movie like this deserved.
Yeah.
But
that's too bad. Number four, Sausage Party with $7.6 million, bringing its total up to $80 million. And that's considered a pretty big hit, right?
Yeah, $19 million budget. And it's also very close to pace. It might actually hit $100 million, too.
Jeez. Okay.
Yeah.
And then number five is Mechanic Resurrection. $7.5 million. What's going on there?
Well, here's the thing. As I hinted earlier, it's like Jason Statham, his movies have never been big hits. He keeps getting hired to do these action movies, and none of them have done really big business. But now he's been in Furious 7, and, he was really hilarious in Spy, and that did very well. So to do a movie like this and to spend the exact same amount of money that you spent on the first Mechanic, which was $40 million.
Whoa.
Okay? And I think only one of his movies has actually ever grossed $40 million where he was the lead.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that was the second Transporter movie, I believe.
Uh-huh.
So that's just fiscally irresponsible. Because Transporter 3 is the only one of his films ever to gross $100 million worldwide.
Wow. Those numbers are very surprising to me. I don't know why, because, I just assumed that, Statham's movies make money because he keeps making them.
Yeah, no. I mean, his best opening was Transporter 2, and that was $16.5 million.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, again, these are films where he's the lead, not where he's like a Furious Seven co-star and things like that.
Right.
That's the thing, they keep cranking these Statham movies out over the years, and none of them have made any money. The budgets have varied and whatnot, but if you're going to spend $40 million on a sequel to a movie that everyone forgot already, you better make sure that he's making movies that make $40 million, which they're not.
No, that's $7 million over the weekend, not good.
No.
Number six, Pete's Dragon, $7.2 million, bringing its total up to $54.7 million, which again is sad.
Yeah, also, you know, again, 35% drop. Word of mouth is clearly keeping it around, but, you know, it's not really going to be a hit. And that's really it really makes me sad, just like it does with Kubo.
Yeah. Number seven, War Dogs, $7.2 million. What kind of drop was that?
50%. Mm-hmm. Dropped 50%. Not particularly good. Again, another movie that cost $40 million. Probably not going to hit that in the U.S., and not likely to be a big international hit either. But, you know, Warner Brothers has had a pretty decent summer, so they can kind of write that one off pretty easily.
$27.7 million total.
Yeah.
In 2 weeks. Number eight, Bad Moms, $5.7 million. Man, that's almost up to $100 million.
Yeah, and that's a big thing for this company, STX, which has only been releasing movies for a year now. The first movie they released was The Gift last summer, which was, I think, their biggest hit up until Bad Moms. So they're going to pull off an $100 million release in their first year. Focus has been releasing movies since 2000. They've never had a movie make $100 million.
Really?
Yeah. The highest grossing movie in Focus's history is Brokeback Mountain.
Wow.
$83 million in the U.S.
$83 million, that's it.
Yeah, and they're the ones releasing the Leica movies.
Yep, I know. So Bad Moms, boy, that's a solid hit then.
Yeah, really solid hit.
Yeah, okay. Number nine, Jason Bourne, $5.2 million, bringing his total up to $149 million. That's less than the other ones?
Yeah, Supremacy did 176, Ultimatum did like 227, so it's going to come in less than those two movies. But it's made over $347 million worldwide, and that's second most for the Bourne movies.
Now, how does it compare to the Renner film?
It's outgrossed the Renner film.
Yeah.
Renner film grossed, I think, just past $100 million in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
So it's well past that, and I think it did some like 280-something worldwide. So that was kind of a minor loser.
Yeah.
For them. Not a big one.
Right. And then number 10, Ben-Hur. $4.5 million. It's total $19.5 million in 2 weeks. And again, the budget on this one?
$100 million.
Oh, God.
$100 million is tanking overseas as well. It's like $41 million worldwide right now. Just based on budgets versus worldwide gross, this is the bomb of the summer at the moment.
Yeah. Well,
that might alter a little bit in the coming weeks, but right now it is the bomb of the summer.
Well, it's like Gladiator meets Fast and the Furious.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I wanted to pose this question to you, Nick, about the box office, because I found this very interesting, because this week was, to me, is sort of a lesson for the studios in when to release something, to platform something, or to get it out there.
Yeah.
And because you think, look at Don't Breathe, which does $26.1 million, doesn't really have stars. It's sold basically on being a horror premise and stuff like that.
Right.
And it gets out there wide and does a huge opening. Do you think A24 is kicking themselves a little bit in the fact that they didn't release Green Room wide?
Yeah, I think so.
You know?
Because they're very similar
in
style and in tone.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I totally agree with
South,
you.
I mean, Roadside gets Southside with you out there in the same amount of screens that Hands of Stone is in this week,
right?
And that ended up doing $3 million. Didn't make the top 10, but did $3 million.
Right.
And look at what Lionsgate is doing with Hell or High Water.
Right.
Which has been, you know, it's steadily making money, but now it's like it doubled its screens this week. I think it's on like 900 screens this week or something
like
that.
Right.
But people are talking about this movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, not just critics, too. It's actually getting out there in the public. They better get this thing out there and, you know, forget about the Statham movie.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, before it's too late.
Yeah, that's a good thought. All right, well, listen, we're off next week for Labor Day, so have a great week.
Yeah.
And then when we come back, we got Clint Eastwood's Sully to talk about.
And Toronto.
And you're going to Toronto.
I'll be in Toronto that weekend.
When do you leave?
Leave on Wednesday the 7th, come back on the 15th.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll get live reports from Toronto when you're covering the Toronto Film Festival.
You certainly will.
All right, Eric, thanks, buddy.
You got it.
There you go. We'll talk to Eric next week, and he will be in Toronto. So there you go. All right, we'll take a quick break here. We got weather, and we got traffic coming up next.